Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Hello. Before you start your podcast, my name's Greg Jenner. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the Radio 4 comedy show that takes history seriously. And I'm delighted to say we have a new series coming soon. As ever, I'm joined by top historians and fantastic comedians to talk about a wonderful array of historical subjects from all over the world. Stuff you did at school and stuff you've never even heard of. So if that sounds like fun, if you want to come and laugh while you learn, then check out You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Charlotte Gallagher, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 23rd of February, these are our main stories. Leaders of the 9 European easternmost NATO countries have called for a greater allied military presence in the face of Russian aggression in Ukraine. The UN General Assembly is meeting in New York to discuss the war with Ukraine, and its allies are hoping for an overwhelming vote condemning Russia. Israeli troops have killed at least 10 Palestinians, including both civilians and militants, during a raid in the occupied West Bank. Also in this podcast.
We want to make sure that there are ringers for every church so that we can all ring out the ring for the king for the coronation.
The calls go out for potential bell ringers. There are concerns that some church towers in England will be silent for May's historic event. First, if Russia's aim in invading Ukraine nearly a year ago was to reduce the presence of NATO around its borders, that goal seems further away than ever and looks likely to become more remote. Most of the so-called Bucharest Nine, all former members of the Soviet bloc, want NATO troops stationed permanently in the region. That's what they've said to President Biden, who met them in Warsaw on Wednesday. There, Mr. Biden made a direct comparison between the Second World War and President Putin's invasion of Ukraine. He also reiterated his promise of US support to NATO members.
We will defend literally every inch of NATO, every inch of NATO. And this is an important moment. I look forward to the discussion and the next steps we can take together and to keep our alliance strong and to further deter aggression. Literally, at stake is not just Ukraine, it's freedom.
The Romanian president, Klaus Iohannis, who's co-hosting the meeting with his Polish counterpart, underlined the strong feelings.
Almost 1 year ago, Russia tried to destroy the European and Euro-Atlantic security and the rules-based international order. Russia is acting on a pattern of aggressive conduct, which we have already witnessed in the Republic of Moldova, in Georgia, and in Ukraine itself.
I spoke to our correspondent in Warsaw, Adam Easton, and asked him if there had been any concrete decisions decided at the meeting.
The joint declaration following the meeting, Charlotte, doesn't actually mention any concrete decisions. It does condemn Russia's war of aggression and vows to hold accountable those responsible for war crimes. It also says Ukraine's future lies in Europe, but it doesn't explicitly mention Ukraine joining NATO. For concrete decisions, we may have to wait for the NATO leaders' summit in Vilnius in July.
Obviously a show of unity, but I presume for Russia, that's going to be really provocative, this meeting and the promises to defend every inch of NATO soil by America.
Oh, yeah, indeed, it is, will be seen by Moscow as provocative. But the main purpose of Mr. Biden's trip has been to show that NATO is still united, still committed to helping Ukraine, because the American president knows very well that Russia is counting on war fatigue and divisions within Europe. And it is a legitimate concern, because even in this region, where there is pretty broad consensus about the Russian threat, Hungary, for example, has not provided any military assistance to Kyiv, and it's calling for a ceasefire and a negotiated settlement. So those divisions within Europe are there. not just between East and West, but also within this region as well. So it is a real concern.
And obviously, Ukraine dominated most of the talks, the majority. But what else did they discuss?
Well, what we do know outside of the joint declaration, which was sort of broad generalities, afterwards, the Polish and Lithuanian president said they had asked President Biden in the meeting for more military equipment. Specifically, in the case of Lithuania, they asked for modern rocket launchers, helicopters and airspace surveillance capabilities. And also, President Duda of Poland, he didn't say this was mentioned in the meeting, but he did talk about fighter jets that Ukraine wants. And he said that that has to be a decision for all NATO, not for individual countries. But he said Poland was willing to send its old Soviet era MiG fighter jets if it could do that within a coalition.
That was Adam Easton. As we record this podcast, the UN General Assembly is meeting in New York to discuss the war in Ukraine, with Kyiv and its allies hoping an overwhelming majority of members will condemn Russia. A motion has been tabled calling on Russia to withdraw from all Ukrainian territory. The vote has no legal effect, but those behind it have said it will send a message about the strength of support for Ukraine internationally. Ukraine's Foreign Minister, Dmytro Kuleba, said it was time for all countries to back the resolution.
I understand that there are still some countries that do not want to take Ukraine's side for various reasons. But it's not about that. It's about taking the side of the United Nations Charter. It's about taking the side of international law.
I spoke to our UN correspondent, Neda Taufik, who's in New York, and asked her how much support is there for the motion under debate.
Ukraine and their supporters, obviously the West, are hoping that they get close to the number of support that they've gotten with previous General Assembly resolutions. Those include two from March that denounced the invasion, that called for, you know, the humanitarian situation to improve and criticized Russia for it. And then one from October that condemned Russia's illegal annexation. And in all of those votes, they got more than 140 members out of the 193 body. So really only a handful of countries voted alongside Russia in those resolutions. Many more chose rather to abstain from the vote at all. So that is what Western nations are hoping, because for them, on the, you know, leading into the 1 year anniversary, they're really hoping to once again show just how isolated Russia is all these months on.
Obviously, it sends a message and it's symbolic if this is backed. But is Russia paying any attention to this, really?
Yeah, I mean, we have to remember, right, that this is a General Assembly resolution. It's where Russia doesn't have a veto, like the Security Council. So like you say, it is very much symbolic. I don't think anybody is under the illusion that this is going to change President Putin's calculus or change anything on the ground. But rather, I think it's very important for the international community, from the West's perspective, to be able to say that they are going to stand up to the principles of the UN Charter.
Neda Taufik. Hours earlier, the Russian President Vladimir Putin met Beijing's top foreign affairs official Wang Yi in Moscow. Wang Yi said the relationship between China and Russia would not be influenced by what was happening with other nations.
We would like to emphasize once again that the comprehensive strategic partnership between Russia and China has never been directed against a third party. It is certainly not subject to interference and provocation by any third party. We will not be overwhelmed by coercion and pressure from third parties.
And President Putin appeared to have confirmed that his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping is planning a visit to the Russian capital. Mr. Putin then went on to address crowds filling Moscow's main stadium for a patriotic gala, from where our correspondent Steve Rosenberg reports.
The Kremlin put on a show to rally Russians around their president and his war in Ukraine. At the stadium, which hosted the 2018 Football World Cup final, patriotic pop songs were the warm-up act, plus speeches reminding Russians that their country had defeated Napoleon and Hitler and would be victorious in Ukraine. The event was highly stage-managed. Tens of thousands of people had been bussed in from colleges, factories, and state enterprises.
President of the Russian Federation! Владимир Владимирович Путин!
Enter Vladimir Putin.
Прямо сейчас идет бой на наших...
Sharing the stage with Russian soldiers back from the front line, the Kremlin leader declared, right now there is a battle on our historical frontiers for our people. They are fighting heroically, courageously, bravely. Three cheers, hurrah!
Трижды ура! Ура! Ура!
State propaganda here tells Russians that it was the West that started the war in Ukraine. Many in the stadium seem to believe that.
Это точно не мы начали. Как просто...
We didn't start all this, Irina tells me. I trust our president. Not everyone here, though, was so enthusiastic. In temperatures of minus 15, we saw large crowds streaming away from the stadium, even before Vladimir Putin arrived.
Steve Rosenberg in Russia. On Friday, it's exactly a year since Russia launched its invasion into Ukraine. Despite the war, life in some form carries on in the country. But Kyiv has changed enormously since the 24th of February last year. And a newly released album called Kyiv Eternal by the Ukrainian musician Oleh Shepdeko tries to capture the sounds of those changes. It's a document of a city that the artist says has changed forever.
I returned to Kyiv after the Battle of Kyiv was finished. So I experienced Kyiv right after the battle, and it was very different from what I imagined it would be. I could hear every car that was passing, every like shot or explosion I could hear distinctly. I come from a Russian-speaking family, and I used to admire Russian culture before that. And I used to read in Russian mostly, like in English and in Russian. And now I just stopped reading in Russian. I can't. I still speak Russian with my friends who still speak Russian, but publicly, like in officially, I use either Ukrainian or English. As for sounds that made Kyiv Kyiv, I think they're still there, because maybe in a month or two, Kyiv kind of got back to the usual peace, more or less peaceful mode of functioning. I remember the most exciting experience was when I actually was stuck in a traffic jam in Kyiv during the war, because it meant that the city is alive, you know, and it was a very positive experience back then. The whole mood of the album is not really depressive or melancholic. I would say it's hopeful. It's more like light and hopeful. It is dealing with the themes of the past that we don't have access to anymore. So we can't really return to this past before the full-scale invasion. And we had a certain image of our future, certain... you know, every past has its future. And so we can't really have anymore this future that we had in this past, and we can't return to it. And this is what this album is about for me.
That was Oleh Shepdeko. Now to other news. The US State Department says it's extremely concerned by levels of violence in Israel and the West Bank. The comments come on the day Israeli forces killed at least 10 Palestinians, including three gunmen, and wounded more than 100 during a raid. The Israeli military said its troops came under fire when targeting what it called militant suspects in a hideout apartment in the flashpoint city of Nablus. From there, our Middle East correspondent Tom Bateman reports.
Explosions and gunfire sounded in the heart of Nablus as armoured troop carriers and soldiers with dogs raided the narrow streets of the old city. It triggered armed clashes with Palestinian gunmen before Israeli troops fired shoulder-launched missiles at a house in which three senior Palestinian militants were holed up, having said they wouldn't surrender. Israel says they were involved in the killing of a soldier last year and were planning imminent attacks. but several of those killed outside are civilians, including two elderly men, while footage shows young men apparently unarmed running away as gunshots are heard before one falls to the ground. The Israeli army said it was reviewing the video. Palestinian officials called it a massacre, while the militant group Hamas said its patience was running out. After a spate of Palestinian armed attacks, Israel's military search and arrest raids in the occupied West Bank have intensified over the last year, and this one is one of the deadliest since 2005, with a huge number also injured. It is a further sign that recent attempts by the US to ease spiralling tensions are failing.
Tom Bateman in Nablus. The authorities in Madagascar are taking stock of the damage caused by Cyclone Freddy, which hit the island on Tuesday. At least four people have died as heavy rain and powerful winds ripped roofs off houses and triggered a storm surge. The storm has weakened and is now leaving Madagascar, heading to the African mainland. The BBC's Dorcas Wangira is in Madagascar.
What we have gathered, we were able to speak to the Director General of the BNGRC. That's the agency that deals with catastrophes and disasters. And what they told us, this was at around midday, was that by the end of today, Wednesday, the cyclone will have already passed and will be heading towards the Mozambican Channel. However, that doesn't mean that people should not remain vigilant. And so far, four people are reported to have died. More than 16,000 people have been displaced. And also the need is still there. The people who have had the roofs of their houses ripped off. We saw the Mananjari Stadium, its roof had also been ripped off. Reports we gathered from MSF was that the hospital in Mananjari also was impacted. And we've also seen photographs of people in shelters. When the cyclone made its landfall, it was moving at a speed of 195 kilometers per hour. Those are its gusts near the eye. But right now it has weakened. It's actually a tropical storm. It is moving away towards Madagascar. It has been moving across the southwest. And as it prepares or as it enters into the Mozambican Channel, the speed that it's moving at, it's almost 130 going to 85 kilometers per hour. However, this doesn't mean that the storm is over. There's still heavy rainfall in other areas and there has been flooding.
That was Dorcas Wangira in Madagascar. Still to come.
If people want olive oil, they can come and have olive oil, but to start adding it to coffee, where will it end?
Would you drink olive oil with your coffee? A major American coffee company is launching a series of such drinks. Lawyers for a woman deprived of her British citizenship have vowed to fight on after her latest legal attempt to get it back failed. 23-year-old Shamima Begum travelled from London to Syria to join the Islamic State group when she was 15. She was later stripped of her citizenship by the British government, which argued she represented a security threat. Ms. Begum, though, insists she was a victim of trafficking, and a judge at Wednesday's Special Appeals Tribunal said this was possible. But the judge also found the government had a legal right to take her citizenship away. Her legal team, though, said the case was nowhere near over and the decision will be challenged. Here's her lawyer, Gareth Pearce.
The implication, the outcome that we face is that no British child who has been trafficked outside the UK will be protected by the British state if the Home Secretary invokes national security.
The case could have implications for an estimated 60 other people from Britain and dozens of their children who are still in camps in Syria. The BBC's legal correspondent, Dominic Casciani, told me more.
The court said in Miss Begum's case, there was a credible suspicion that she had been trafficked to Syria within all the legal definitions of what that amounts to, and that she had been a victim of sexual exploitation as a child, and she could have been stopped from going by the British authorities. But, and this is the crucial bit, none of that trumps the discretion that the government has and ministers to decide what constitutes a national security threat. So even though she went out as a victim, because she'd aligned herself with the Islamic State group, she was then in a position where MI5 and other security agencies in the UK were advising ministers that steps had to be taken to protect the public from her. And in this case, the Home Secretary, the minister who took the decision, said the best way to do that is to strip her of her nationality. And that's a very broad discretion the minister has. And that, in essence, makes it very, very hard for her to win her case. You know, she's lost today. She's going to try to appeal it. But also has real ramifications for other cases as well, because it reinforces this idea that the government has a really, really broad discretion in deciding who is or is not a national security threat.
Because some other countries have begun taking these women and children back, haven't they? Is Britain a bit of an outlier in how it's dealing with Shamima Begum and other people like her?
Well, it seems to be at the moment. And I think this is a bit of a bone of contention between the UK and some of its allies. Certainly, Washington has raised concerns in the past. When IS fell, if you think back to 2019 when the regime collapsed and people were literally fleeing the war zone, some of whom were exceptionally dangerous people, Washington was putting pressure onto the British government at the time, saying, you've got to do your bit to take these people out of the region. And the UK was saying, we're not having any of this. In fact, they were basically trying to block as many people as possible from coming home. We think there were about 100 similar situations to Shamima Begum where people were stripped of nationality or had passports cancelled so they couldn't travel. Some countries since then have started taking people home. We know the Germans have been doing a lot of that. The French couldn't bar people from coming home because of the way their constitution works. We know lots of people have gone home to France. We know that the Danes have done it. Some of the other Scandinavian countries have done it. So the UK is in a bit of a weird category there. Now, what makes it interesting, though, Charlotte, is there are people who have returned home quietly and sometimes with the cooperation or the oversight of the security authorities, and they've been debriefed after they've got back. I know this from my own sources in the security community. These things have happened. And it appears that in some cases they've said that person can possibly safely get on with their life. They may not be a threat, or maybe we're going to monitor them quietly. But the Begum case became such a totem for the government, it decided it wasn't going to let her back in. And I think as time goes on, the question starts to build about, do we really want her to be left out there? And what impact does that have on regional security? But also, what pressure London is going to potentially come under from particularly Washington and others who want to actually try and rebuild Syria at a certain point or try and clean up what is still a very, very messy and awful situation.
That was Dominic Casciani. Footballers have raised concerns about the environmental impact of the world governing body FIFA's plans to expand global competitions. Their criticism comes as an entirely new tournament to decide the final three qualifiers for the Women's World Cup wraps up in New Zealand. Some players believe that FIFA's expansion plans contradict its commitment to reducing football's carbon footprint, as our sports news correspondent Alex Capstick reports.
Fans from Argentina celebrating their team's spectacular World Cup triumph in Qatar. The tournament was watched by a global audience of billions, making it by far the most popular single sports event on the planet, with profits to match.
The financial statements are looking extremely, extremely good, so this shows how strong FIFA is today, which means...
And the FIFA president, Gianni Infantino, wants to build on that success. It means international football is set to become even bigger, but not necessarily better.
Is it ignorance, or is it just that they don't care?
David Wheeler plays for Wickham Wanderers in the third tier of English football. He also has the title of sustainability champion at the Players' Union, and he's aghast at FIFA's expansion plans. Like the next Men's World Cup, which has been bumped up to 48 teams, with matches spread across the USA, Canada and Mexico.
They tried to claim carbon neutrality for the Qatar World Cup, which was probably one of the most carbon-intensive events after the two world wars. They're now having a World Cup over a continent, which is insane. It seems like it's a money-making exercise at the expense of all else.
A la Madrid! Vamos!
FIFA is also upgrading the Men's Club World Cup. Real Madrid won the latest competition held recently in Morocco, a relatively low-profile event contested by just seven teams. But the revamp, scheduled for 2025, will involve 32 clubs. FIFA's hunger for more has also extended to the women's game. A record 32 nations will compete at this year's World Cup, with a brand new event added to the list. This was the traditional welcome for the 10 teams who've been competing in New Zealand over the past week for the final three World Cup qualifying slots, a tournament which raises more questions over FIFA's commitment to lower its carbon emissions.
My name is Diane Caldwell, and I represent the Irish national team, Republic of Ireland.
Diane is also part of a group of international players called We Play Green, who speak out on environmental issues.
I'm sure FIFA will say they've done it to help the women's game grow there. Of course, we all want the women's game to grow, but it can still be done in a sustainable way and not by flying 10 teams from different continents to New Zealand to compete in 13 extra games, you know.
In response, FIFA issued a statement saying the new playoff tournament was a collective decision by leaders of all the international confederations. It also insists substantial efforts have been made to tackle the environmental impact when increasing the number of fixtures. The global game is already big business, but do big profits have to come at a big cost to the planet? Or can football find a new tactic to tackle climate change?
That was Alex Capstick reporting. Now something for all coffee drinkers, or maybe not. The American chain Starbucks has unveiled plans to try to break into the Italian market by adding a Mediterranean twist to its coffee. It's launching a series of drinks infused with olive oil, including a latte, which it boasts has a velvety smooth texture. Shops in the UK will serve the new blend later this year, but it isn't to the taste of some traditionalists. Antonio Polidri, who owns an independent Italian coffee bar in central London, dismissed the new drinks as a gimmick.
How can they even think about going to Italy and teaching Italians about coffee? Got a business that's been running in this street for 75 years next year, and it's successful. I don't want to tinker with it. If people want olive oil, they can come and have olive oil, but to start adding it to coffee, where will it end?
James Menendez spoke to Francesco Sanapo, a champion Italian barista from the Italian city of Florence. So what does he think about mixing coffee and olive oil?
Well, I'm in love with every new idea. So I'm the Italian person who always look forward to see new things. I think they just simply infused beans with olive oil and then they will use this as an ingredient for the beverage they will make. I think it's an interesting idea.
You don't sound totally convinced. I mean, Starbucks say that it gives the coffee a velvety, buttery flavour. Do you think that's likely to be true?
Correct, because olive oil is just fat, if you think it's a very fatty product, okay? So, and then when you shake it or when you blend it with coffee, you can create this velvety, tasty, you know, flavors and as well body. I did the same things with butter, for example. I used butter for one of our signature drink at the Artigianale, so, and it was very successful.
Right. What you put butter in a coffee, did you?
Correct, but it's not the only one. I always try to combine coffee with many other products, and one of the most successful in my cafe was the cheese and coffee. So
really?
No one expected. Yes, man. And we mix cheese with coffee, but if you consider one of the biggest and famous cake in the world is a cheesecake. So don't be scandalized if we use cheese and coffee together.
So you basically made a sort of drinkable cheesecake?
Fantastic. You're right. It's an experiment, you know, and it's a way to present and create a trendy type of coffee.
Francesco, I have to say, I mean, I admire your approach to innovation. I just wonder, though, whether Italians generally are pretty conservative when it comes to their coffee.
Yes, man. Yes, I think the Italians are very traditional, and the people who order espresso, they will never go around. They will never change. And probably it's not the people where you are going to offer the new things. My company was founded 10 years ago, and we still have difficulty to sell a single origin espresso. Imagine to sell olive oil and espresso.
That was Francesco Sanapo, a champion Italian barista in Florence. With just 10 weeks to go, there are concerns some church towers in the UK will be silent over the 6th of May weekend, the time of King Charles's coronation, because of a shortage of bell ringers. Current estimates suggest there are 30 to 40,000 ringers across the UK and more are needed. Joe Black has been to Ipswich in eastern England to meet a team of bell ringers preparing to ring for the king.
On the waterfront at Ipswich, the bells at the Church of St Clement ring out. It's a deconsecrated church, and this isn't the weekly service. It's a training session.
Balance to balance, so when we ring rounds in a minute, you can control, that's it. Now control the backstroke.
Most of the new recruits have answered the call to ring for the king, a recent appeal by the campanology community to get more people interested in acquiring this skill. Among them, Freya, a 17-year-old A-level student who has been ringing since November and says being involved on coronation weekend will be something to remember.
It's like been something I've been interested in, but I suppose Ring for the King made me think this is the time to get into it.
All yours.
Amanda Richmond from the Association of Ringing Teachers is guiding the new members and is pleased with their progress.
We want to make sure that there are ringers for every church so that we can all ring out for Ring for the King for the coronation.
In some areas of the country, bell ringing is thriving. Those here at St Paul's in Birmingham are aged between 11 and 80 years old, and their bell ringing school is full. But in other places, there can be very few. Simon Linford is from the Central Council of Church Bell Ringers.
We probably had a couple of decades of not really realising that the ringing community was getting older and failing to replace ourselves, but now we're actively looking to replace ourselves.
It takes around 10 to 12 hours of one-to-one tuition to get a basic level of ringing. Still time to learn ahead of May the 6th.
That was Jo Black with some bell ringers preparing for the coronation of King Charles. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @globalnewspod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. And I'm Charlotte Gallagher. Until next time, goodbye.
Hi, I'm Namulanta Kombo, and I'm excited to tell you that my award-winning podcast, Dear Daughter, returns on the 27th of February for a brand new season. Dear Daughter is a podcast from the BBC World Service full of personal insight and thoughtful letters of advice. It's a handbook to life for daughters everywhere. So, if you haven't already, catch up with the first season now while you're waiting for season two. Search for Dear Daughter wherever you get your BBC podcasts.